Hello, and welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Magda Zenon, recording from Nicosia, and in my virtual studio, I have Crystal Downing all the way from New York, New York. Welcome, Crystal.
Hi, Magda. Great to be here.
To introduce you to the listener, you lead the International Crisis Group analyzing how conflict impacts people of different genders and their diverse roles in preventing and responding to conflict. Do I have it right?
Yeah, I'm the project director for gender and conflict at Crisis Group. Yep.
When someone looks at your trajectory, your career trajectory, you had an unexpected start, which is you started in music, and then you moved to an NGO in Bolivia working with women in prisons. Take us from there, because I find that quite an interesting subject and something that I think was very instrumental on the why you went where you went in your career.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was restarting my career because I had started in the music industry and decided that wasn't for me. So I took an internship with an NGO in Bolivia that placed me with a local organization that was working in five prisons in the Cochabamba area. And the idea was for me to do a little bit of programming, implementation, and then a little bit of research and reporting on human rights issues. And one of the five prisons was a women's prison, and the other four were all men's prisons. And I just got really interested in the issues that the women were facing in particular, that many of the men were not. And most of those issues were kind of stemmed from the fact that the in Bolivia, you have to pay to be in prison. The Bolivian prison system is staggeringly underfunded. And so prisoners have to pay for their own kind of food and lodging. And so they need to have jobs. But they also can't, their families usually can't maintain a home outside the prison. And so children come and live, especially in the women's prisons with the women prisoners, which means that they obviously have additional care responsibilities on top of having to provide for their own food and lodging. And so they have jobs that provide for their families, and their children leave the prison every morning, go to school, come back in the afternoon. And they have those care responsibilities in a very insulated environment where they have no further support. So I got interested. That's actually
quite a bizarre system that you actually not only have they put you in jail, they actually make you pay to stay there. What happens if you don't pay? You starve.
It's a great question. Yeah. I mean, first of all, you don't eat. And I think as far as I remember, there was lodging for prisoners who couldn't pay, but none of the lodging was particularly luxurious by any means, or even decent, but some of it was really, really kind of miserable, and the conditions were extremely poor, and that was usually where the prisoners who were unable to pay were. But it really was unusual for them not to pay something. And part of the reason for that was because NGOs like the one that I was working with were supporting them in job training and supporting their livelihood and income generation activities. So, but it is certainly unusual, as you say.
What kind of jobs were they doing? Were they doing the gender jobs like cooking and cleaning and sewing?
Yeah, so there was a lot of frustration. That was one of the things that really came out and that got me interested in how these gender-based assumptions about people's roles in society can affect women and men in different ways. So the jobs that were offered to women in the women's prison were things like laundering. So people would bring their clothes to be laundered in the prison. Cooking, cleaning, not so much because they would have had to leave the prison, but certainly cooking, food kind of production and laundry were two big ones at the women's prison, whereas the men were making furniture and making barbecues and those jobs actually generated more income.
More lucrative. Than the women's jobs. Much more lucrative.
Yeah. Yeah. So there was a lot of frustration, yeah.
I think what I also read is that in another side learning curve in that job was you actually realized why people commit crimes. You had found out a new dimension of why people, it's not as simple as you're a bad person and you shoot someone.
Absolutely. I mean, that there was a lot of, I spoke to a lot of prisoners who, and to understand their stories, we kind of got into their lives before they were in prison and before they had committed whatever crime they were in there for. And yeah, it became very clear that many of them were living in poverty. And there was one man who I remember very clearly who was looking after his mother. He was responsible for his mother, and his mother needed very specific and quite costly medications. And 1 month he was unable to pay for the medication. And so he had entered a pharmacy to try and steal the medication. And the pharmacy owner had come down the stairs and to kind of confront him. This was in the middle of the night. And they ended up getting into a physical altercation, and he ended up killing the pharmacy owner, which obviously, I mean, is a crime. And he fully understood that that was why he was in prison, and, you know, that he was certainly, you know, the law had done its job in the sense that he had been prosecuted and convicted and was in prison. But the reasons behind the crime were, you know, very genuine ones, which was that he wanted to provide for his mother and she needed this medication. So it revealed definitely some of the complexities behind crime, and that led me into an interest that later on kind of resulted in me going into DDR and looking at why ex-combatants or why people become involved in armed groups, and then the kind of support that they need when they come out of armed groups and they go into DDR programs. So yeah.
Did that also include women combatants?
Yeah, because absolutely.
I think in South America, especially in Colombia, you have a lot of women that are combatants in the militia, in the field.
Yeah. So some of the groups had a higher proportion of women than others. And still to this day, that is true. But certainly at the time that I was in Colombia, the peace process was going on, and I was working in the DDR program of an international organization. And
just explain what DDR is.
Sorry, it's disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration of ex-combatants. Okay. So it's the process of handing over your weapons and becoming kind of dismantling the armed group and then reintegrating and becoming a civilian, I guess, once again. Mm-hmm. So it's all about the kinds of support that you need in the short, medium, and long term in order to be able to do that. And this was 10 years ago now, or a little bit more. And there was certainly an awareness that women needed a specific or several specific types of support in terms of everything, health and education and job training. And there was several, you know, there were different areas that we worked on, but it was still, I think, quite nascent in its application. So there was a lot of kind of policies on paper, but how it actually was rolled out in practice was, there was a lot of room for growth or room for improvement, I suppose.
What was right? It was at the beginning of this process. So putting into place things like gender or what was needed was not part of the thought process when this DDR was first started.
Well, so the DDR process that I was working on at the time was actually first rolled out in the early 2000s when the paramilitary groups demobilized. And in the paramilitary groups, there were women, but not as many as there were proportionately, for example, in the FARC that signed the peace agreement in 2016. So the 2016 process started after I was in Colombia, and that certainly had more gender provisions in it than earlier processes had, partially as a result of the gender provisions in the peace agreement, in the 2016 peace agreement, which, as you know, is known around the world for the amount of content that it holds on gender and the ways that gender interacts with conflict and peace building. So
It's quite a milestone, a shining light, the Colombian peace process, although we all know shining lights have a lot of dimmings because they work at the beginning, but then it's also in implementation and sustainability, and that's often not ideal. It's a working process, and it also needs good intention, which sometimes is not always in place.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think as so much of gender equality work at the global level at the moment, there's there are two main issues, which are political will and financial ability, and you really need both. And that's a rare combination, especially when, you know, I think there's often political will and a willingness to kind of say positive things about gender equality. But when it comes to allocating funding in this area, that's often not, it doesn't match the amount of political messaging that we see. And I think this year has been absolutely the kind of test of that, and that the little aid or the sort of lower proportion of aid that there was supporting gender equality has fallen away, and the political will is also greatly decreased. So,
I don't know where we're going to go. Let's just take goodwill going forward and see where we can take it, because I think a lot of us are rather in despair about how low gender can fall on the agenda and how much we can do with no money, because that's what's happening at the moment. But then the job that cemented your connection between gender and conflict was when you came back to the States, wasn't it? And you did work on migration.
I worked with an NGO first on education and conflict issues that didn't have so much of a gender focus. And then you're talking about when I came back to the US after Bolivia or after Colombia?
After Bolivia.
After Bolivia, I worked in, yes, you're right. So I worked in legal services NGO in Staten Island, New York, which provided free legal services to kind of low-income populations in Staten Island. And my focus in that job was on immigration. And we saw a lot of undocumented immigrants who had been victims of domestic crimes. And so just kind of by that definition, a lot of them were women. And we were able to help them because at the time there was a policy in place whereby if they assisted the police in finding the perpetrator of the crime, then they could have a path to a visa and then eventually to a green card. And so part of my job was to listen to their narratives, not only of the crimes that they had experienced in the United States, in New York, but also of their migration into the US. And often these stories were really, really heartbreaking and extremely extremely difficult experiences that they had been through in order to enter the country.
I mean, I know some of the stories, and then when you hear people talking about they come in illegally, they could have come an easy way, they've taken away our jobs, it's so dehumanizing when you consider that they actually fought for their lives in most cases to get where they wanted to get. They paid a fortune, they often paid with their bodies, the woman. Some of them paid with members of families. So it's this harrowing story of migration is so fraught with so many thorns and pebbles and bullets that it concerns me when I see how much I'm not saying they should let all migrants in. What I'm saying is there should be some understanding of why they needed to come and they wanted to come. And maybe if you made the journey easier, you could get more people, less people in, but with less harrowing stories. Why does everyone need to go through this process anyway? That's a different story. Not really, because gender and violence goes hand in hand.
Migration happens for so many different reasons, and on many of them are gendered. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And then you transitioned from NGOs into international organizations.
Yeah, so I worked for an NGO for a while. This was later, a few years later, after I come back from Colombia and working with the peace process. I came back to New York again and was working for an NGO focused more on education and conflict, and then moved into working at the Security Council from the UK mission to the UN, where one of my files was women, peace and security. And so I was really able to see kind of the international frameworks and how they were applied in the Security Council and kind of at that high international level, which was obviously an enormous contrast to the work that I'd done in the field, and in Colombia in particular. That was an amazing opportunity to see how policymaking in action kind of really looks and feels. And then since then, I moved on to UN University, was working on DDR-related issues for a while, and then now I'm a crisis group.
You also worked for the British Mission, did you not? Work for the British Mission as well? Okay. So you've also you've done the NGO, you've done the international organizations, you've done the diplomacy. So you've done the whole spectrum of the pieces of actually making policy.
Yeah, I think I have found it very useful. I mean, I know there's no right way. I always say, tell people when they ask me for kind of career advice, there's no right way of doing any of this, really. But what felt right to me, at least, was trying to understand all the different angles of policy making, both in terms of how things look on, you know, in country, in conflict, how the national policies look and how international policies and normative frameworks look, and then trying to understand them as well from the perspective of those who make them at the, you know, in the Security Council and around the UN. So, and then the NGO, you know, NGOs and especially kind of research and advocacy, trying to understand these things better and suggest proposals that make sense from a policy and programming perspective and will have a positive impact in conflict. So, yeah.
I'll ask you another question a young girl might have asked you. Did having a PhD help you in your career? Was it necessary?
That's a great question. I only finished my PhD in January. So I would say yes and no. I think when I set out to do it, the experience of defining my interests and proposing a research project that would get me into the PhD program and then going through the ethics review process, particularly around working with children, and kind of going through those really rigorous preparation for producing a thesis on a particular topic, has made me a better researcher for sure. I also feel like, you know, my thesis kind of builds on a variety of my experiences and kind of puts in one place many ideas that I had kind of developed over a few years. So it was certainly satisfying. But in terms of my career progression, I honestly don't know, looking back, that it was like a great differentiator. I'm not sure, you know. I think for some candidates, when I look at people's resumes, you know, sometimes I think, yeah, okay, great. So, you know, if you have two candidates who are perhaps equal in other ways, and one has a PhD and one doesn't, then there are probably certain things that you could assume about someone with a PhD that you might not know about someone who doesn't have one. But by the same token, there are other ways of compensating for those research skills and that knowledge base that you can get elsewhere outside the context of a PhD. So I'm glad that I've done it, but I don't think it's a defining feature of a successful career in this field by any means.
And I would like to agree with you, because I think a lot of the youngsters are under pressure to qualify and qualify and qualify, and believe that if they have 10 qualifications, they're better than the person with the two qualifications. But I think in a lot of cases, it's a combo. You do need some academic qualifications, but if you've been to a prison in Bolivia or Patagonia to examine the wildlife, when you've got practical experience on the ground, that must not be underestimated, because without having that on the ground, you can't do the policy level. It balances out the academic.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm so privileged to work with the colleagues that I work with at Crisis Group, and there's a kind of mix of academic and journalistic backgrounds, and many of them do have just really deep experience reporting investigative journalism and reporting from conflict contexts, and are absolutely phenomenal at what they do. So I think there is certainly a lot of pressure on, I think, young people now coming out of undergraduate degrees to go on and do their masters and then think about a PhD, especially if they want a career in research and advocacy. And I don't think that's necessarily the right path for everyone. For some, sure, but certainly not for all.
And let's get to the burning question. We all know that the space for women's voices is really, really shrinking by the day. How difficult do you find your work now? How much has it impacted your work?
I think, I mean, I'm lucky in the sense that at Crisis Group, we are continuing to do our work as we've always done it. And so I continue to kind of speak out on the areas of gender inequality and conflict that I would have otherwise, and you know, raise the alarm on things that I think are changing, and that's certainly many at the moment. I think that what I see, for example, around the UN is that it's that the current context is really breaking down partnerships and communication between organizations that really need to be able to coordinate. And that's because either organizations have lost so much funding that they don't have the capacity to continue to communicate and to organize and work jointly as they did in the past, or because they're afraid to speak out and afraid of the consequences of doing so. Yeah, it's certainly a challenging environment, and I think over the next few years we're gonna certainly see further breakdown in communication and coordination, and that just means that efforts to push gender equality forward are gonna slow down significantly, as they have already.
I also think we're going to have to become a little bit more creative, because I think without money you've got to be more creative, but also because, as you said, partnerships are breaking down. The traditional partnerships are breaking down. We might need to be looking for partners in different contexts, different areas. So I think it's going to be a hard slog, because it's going to need a lot more thinking and a lot more reaching out and a lot more networking and a lot more research. But I think it's going to be a hard few years ahead of us on every level.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's right. The new kinds of partnerships, I mean, I think, you know, maybe so everything has sort of reached a status quo in terms of who the main partners were and the kinds of organizations that that WPS stakeholders were seeking to work with. And now I think people maybe look outside those traditional boxes, if you will, and figure out kind of, okay, I'm interested in this one specific topic. I wanna work on, I don't know, maternity clinics in Afghanistan. So why don't I find a partner on maternity clinics in Afghanistan? It doesn't have to be on every single aspect of the WPS agenda. It just has to be maternity clinics in Afghanistan, and I'm going to push that forward. And then another organization will say the same on another topic. And I think you'll find new partnerships that I hope will produce really effective and positive results, and partnerships that hopefully will survive into the future past the current kind of global pushback against gender equality. But I do think that that's going to be a key way to drive things forward. Yeah.
As I said, we're going to need to be creative. And I think it already started, about talking about women and peace building and talking beyond the peace processes and negotiations and looking at smaller issues. I mean, dance groups together doing gender. I mean, that's expression. So I think it's going to be a lot more of that, but it's going to be a hard slog, because money is nowhere to be found. Before this pushback, there already was limited funding for things related to gender. Now it's almost vanished. Tell me, is there the things that had been reached before this pushback, did you feel that we were at a good stage? We had reached a good point. Was there not satisfaction? I mean, it's a tough thing, because we haven't reached gender equality, and we're going to need at this stage about 200 more years to reach gender equality. But yeah, were we moving in the right direction?
I think if I really had to define a sort of timeline of like when things were moving forward until, in my head, I would say maybe it's like 2015, 2016, things were still moving forward, I think. And the reason that I say that is because the Security Council Resolution 2242 was adopted in 2015, and that resolution, you would not be able to adopt that today, 10 years later. It was a positive contribution to the WPS agenda. It talks about women's participation in Peace Processes in great detail. It created the informal experts group on women, peace, and security among Security Council members. I mean, the kinds of mechanisms and efforts that it kind of initiated and put into motion would not be agreed upon by council members, I think, in the current context, and even 5 years ago, wouldn't have been agreed. And I think that's sort of symptomatic. Not that the Security Council is the be all and end all of you know, pushing forward gender equality by any means, but I think it's a sort of litmus test of things that are going on elsewhere in international frameworks that. And multilateralism in general that certainly indicate the amount of pushback versus the amount of kind of pushing forward that is possible at any given moment. And I think the current context is the last sort of, I would say, 6 or 7 years have been gradually kind of not backsliding, but much more about holding the ground
yes.
that you already have than instead of pushing things forward. Yeah.
And I think at this particular stage in time that we're living, the international institutions are actually at risk of falling apart. So at this stage, most of them are trying to keep a balance. You look at a Security Council and you think, why can't they declare it a genocide? Okay. Or why can't they force troops to move out of the Ukraine or move out of Gaza? So to me, this year is really a litmus test on every level for the United Nations. And it's a scary thought if it falls apart. Because for the little it does, it still has a lot of value.
Yes. Yeah, it's definitely a scary thought. I know my colleague Richard Gowan has spoken a lot about this in recent months. So he's certainly done a lot of thinking on this. But yeah, I mean, I think it's this year has been a great test of multilateralism in general, and gender equality has been at the center of that. I mean, it's often put forward in kind of narratives of why countries are pushing back against international frameworks. You know, WPS is one of many that's often listed among the things that certain countries don't like about international or about multilateralism in general, countries coming together on agreed subjects. Those kind of principles, those basics are falling away. But then gender equality is also in the sort of fallout of the aid cuts and the financial constraints that are being placed on the UN and other organizations. So it's sort of at the center and also part of the kind of the rubble of what's falling apart.
Tell me, what's on your agenda going forward? You as the gender focal point of the International Crisis Group, what is something you will be focusing on? Because I know at this stage, you certainly can't be focusing on a lot of things, as in there's got to be a lot of focus if we want to get anywhere in this strong pushback.
Yeah, so I think we're going to continue to track the fallout of the aid cuts in the coming foreseeable future. I was going to say the coming year, but really it's going to be more than a year, being realistic. So the effects of the aid cuts on women and girls, in particular, at the moment we're looking particularly at sexual and reproductive healthcare and conflict, but I think that could expand if we see that there are other areas that are particularly hard hit. And then also looking at, you know, the implications of the changes in political messaging that we're seeing from the US and others. What does that mean for the UN's work on women, peace and security and for the work on gender equality and conflict overall, you know, kind of this withdrawal from commitments on gender and women's rights, you know, that will have effects in conflict settings. And I think that's something that we're going to be looking at this year and coming years as well. So the sort of financial and the political side.
And focusing on sexual and reproductive rights in times of conflict. Is that the central area,
That's the area where we've looked so far at the effects of the aid cuts in particular. Mm-hmm. So the financial on the financial side, like this decrease in funding has many effects for gender equality and conflict. The one that we've looked at so far has been access to sexual and reproductive healthcare. On the political side, we'll be looking across the board at all sorts of different women, peace and security commitments. So not just sexual and reproductive healthcare, but, you know, what does it mean that the WPS as a framework is receiving less support?
Okay, because from where I'm sitting, okay, part of the sexual and reproductive rights, the biggest challenge is violence in all its forms in conflict against women, gender-based violence. And sexual and reproductive rights, if it means denying me an abortion or denying me psychological support after rape, it's all part of that thing. And I think the stronger the pushback, I think it's the scarier it becomes for victims of gender-based violence. And yeah, they were scared to come forward now. They were reluctant to come forward now. With the pushbacks we're seeing, it's going to be really hard for them to come forward because they won't know. No, in fact, they can anticipate they're going to face a very harsh environment, which means rather stay with my trauma rather than face the trauma of going through it again and again and again and then having people say, no, it wasn't an issue. Or no, you can't have funding.
Absolutely. I think that's definitely true. I think that's absolutely true. It will access will decrease because women and girls are not seeking it out. They don't feel comfortable kind of looking for the kind of care that they need because of exactly what you just said, because they're scared that the kind of social and political environment doesn't allow for it, but also that care will be less available because clinics have been shut down and services are no longer being provided, and so it will be a combination, I think, of those things among others, but the end result will be certainly that survivors of gender-based violence are not accessing the care that they need. And that obviously has implications, not just for them as individuals, but for society as a whole. And also not just in the short term, but in the longer term as well. You know, some of those effects of sexual violence are long lasting. So
I think that's what stakeholders don't actually understand, is that it's not just the rape. It's not just that act. It's what the outcome of that act, because it might lead to a pregnancy, it might lead to physical problems, it might lead to psychological problems, which means I might not be able to work. So it's like a ripple effect. It's like a stone that you throw into the sea and it ripples around. So I think people underestimate, although the EU had an astronomical figure of what gender-based violence costs each country. But I'll take you to another part now, because in part of your CV, I saw when you were dealing with the migrants and the women, you were listening to the stories of the violence against them. You spoke about the storytelling and the fact that you need to give women the space to speak.
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of an interesting experience because
I'm picking this up because this to me is such a dear subject, because I think we underestimate the value of just giving people that have been through a trauma, whatever it is, of just giving them 5 or 10 minutes to tell their story in silence, in non-judgment, and just that's like a big hug. Just say what you want to say, and I'm here, and I'm listening.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of that, so initially, you know, it was presented to me as this is a sort of administrative task. You have to ask them about their experience coming into the country, ask them about their experience of domestic violence, which was often gender-based violence, and you just take notes because this is all going to go into their application for a visa. And so that was kind of my approach at the beginning. But then I started to realize that no one had ever asked these women about their experiences, and that had given them the sensation that nobody cared. And so the fact that I was asking gave them this opportunity to speak about things that they had never spoken about before. And so I kind of started recrafting those interviews in a way that gave me the information that I needed to support them with the visa application, which was the reason that they were kind of sitting in my office, but also gave them opportunities to speak about things that they wanted to speak about. Obviously, if they were, you know, some of them, you know, were reluctant to speak and didn't feel comfortable. But that's the kind of interview technique, I suppose, that I was unable to take on to later research, is the kind of interpersonal skills and understanding when you have someone sitting in front of you who actually is benefiting from this conversation, and as you say, giving them the extra 5 or 10 minutes to speak, because no one has ever allowed them to do that before. So yeah, it was, I think those kinds of experiences are definitely lacking. And going back to the, you know, services for survivors of sexual violence, you know, it's that psychosocial care is as important as physical health care, and is often unavailable. So that was a great lesson to me. And, you know, if someone gives you an administrative task, don't assume that it's necessarily only administrative. Those tasks are important. They're really important.
How much did those stories impact you? Could you actually, because I worked for a support center once, and I used to really, it was really a challenge to disconnect from the story when I went home. How did they impact you?
It is really hard to disconnect from the story. I mean, some of the stories, especially of the violence that their boyfriends or partners had carried out against them, kind of using their undocumented status to keep them kind of captive in their homes, because, you know, the threat of I'll turn you in to the authorities was certainly a very real one, and so they just endured so much physical and emotional violence that had had a profound effect on them. So yeah, I definitely found it difficult to detach from that. But then I would also get, you know, it made it all the more meaningful when things happened. Like, I remember there was one woman who had been through, I mean, I won't go into detail, but she had just had absolutely awful experiences of violence, like profound levels of violence in the context of her home, and had finally separated from the man who was doing this to her, and eventually got remarried and invited me and the lawyer that I was working with at the time to her wedding at the courthouse, because we had had such a positive, well, she felt that we had had such a positive impact on her life by helping her to kind of leave the violent situation. And so that, you know, those kinds of experiences really also impact me and don't leave me. So I think it's, you know, you have to, you kind of take all of it with you and apply those lessons to your work as you go forward. But
you also apply lessons to your life, because I think that learning active listening, or actually giving someone who's in trouble, whether it's a girlfriend that you're sharing a glass of wine with, if you actually give her 5 or 10 minutes extra rather than saying, oh, it's you again and whatever, I think you underestimate the importance of it. And I think this wedding that you invited to reminded you of the fact that you gave her 10 minutes and look what it gave her back. Look where it brought her. So I think it reminds you that time is never a waste. Giving people time is never a waste.
Yeah. And the human side, there's always a human. Sometimes, you know, when it's, I think there's always a risk that the hearing these stories, and in the research, the work that I do now, you know, hearing the stories becomes sort of not a habit, but there is a risk that you'll turn off to that level of detail when actually you need to keep that human engagement in order to really to listen as you need to listen and understand experiences in a meaningful way. So,
and I agree with you. You can't just say, "Well, give you 5 minutes and sit and play on your telephone." You actually have to be looking them in the eye, and there has to be active listening, or else it's of no value to them or to yourself. I suppose we're coming to the end of this. What I'd like to say is that, you know, in all the work that we're both doing, what keeps you motivated? Because there are a lot of challenges. You're always getting the fight back, the kickback, and gender is not important. And let's not. What keeps you motivated? What keeps you going every day?
I think the people, you know, the people who work on women, peace, and security, and gender equality. You know, it's like a community. Even if you don't know everyone, obviously, because it's global, but it is a sort of global community of people all working together in an enormous system towards one very broad goal of gender equality, which means very different things to different people in different places, but there's certainly unifying aspects to it, and especially in moments like the Commission on the Status of Women CSW in March, and then upcoming Women, Peace and Security Month in October, you get these moments where you convene, you're in the room or in a virtual space with people having conversations about basically how to drive gender equality forward is what it essentially comes down to. And it's just very inspiring because everyone is working so hard to drive it forward, or at least, as I said, to hold the ground as it is at the moment. And that's an extremely difficult thing to do, especially for people in conflict contexts, women in conflict contexts who are really working so hard every day. And so, yeah, that's I think the inspiration is just that we're all kind of in it together, and it's a just cause, and we need to continue to pursue it.
And we need to continue to have each other's backs.
Yeah,
I think that's also important. Absolutely. That we all, I mean, in a lot of things you do, you are alone, but ultimately you're not alone, because at the end of the day, you can reach out to someone for a shoulder to cry on, a bit of advice, research input. So I think we need to continue this good fight, because it's just the right thing to do. Just the right thing to do. Do you want to say anything else before we close?
No, I think, Magda, just thank you very much for the opportunity to have this conversation. I'm really happy that we connected, and would love to stay in touch going forward. So thank you.
I thank you. I know what keeps me going is my podcasts. Every person I speak to, every woman I speak to, inspires me and makes me realize I'm not alone. And makes me realize that some really awesome people in this work doing incredible work. Most of us not paid according to the work we're putting in, but we're doing it because it's the right thing to do. So to me, the network I've made and the people I've met is what keeps me going. So I thank you. And yes, let's keep in touch.
Sounds good. Thanks, Magda.
Have a lovely rest of the day. And to the listeners, stay safe.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open. Diverse. Free.